hingehört und nachgefragt. Informationen und Kritik zu Fortpflanzungs- und Gentechnologie. Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von Hingehört und Nachgefragt, dem Podcast des Genethischen Netzwerks. Der Wert von Bäumen für die Menschheit kann nicht überschätzt werden, denn sie sind wichtiger Rohstofflieferant, Lebensraum und kulturelles Gut. WissenschaftlerInnen arbeiten mit Gentechnik, um sie an die menschliche Nutzung und an Umweltbedingungen anzupassen, die sie zunehmend unter Druck setzen. Die bisherigen Ergebnisse sind jedoch bescheiden und die Kritik beständig. Auf dem amerikanischen Kontinent könnten dennoch bald gentechnisch veränderte Bäume wachsen, gegen die Widerstände von einigen indigenen Communities. Eine langjährige Kritikerin von gentechnisch veränderten Bäumen ist Anne Petermann. Sie ist die Geschäftsführerin vom Global Justice Ecology Project und die Koordinatorin der Stop GE Trees Kampagne. In ihrer Kritik vereint sie gesellschaftliche mit ökologischen Perspektiven. Judith Duisberg vom Genethischen Netzwerk spricht mit Anne Petermann über die möglichen Folgen vom Anbau von gentechnisch verändertem Eukalyptus in Brasilien sowie den Widerstand von indigenen und anderen betroffenen Communities. Ein weiteres Thema ist die amerikanische Kastanie in den USA und in Kanada, die durch Gentechnik gerettet werden sollte. Doch dann passierten einige Fehler. Seid gespannt und viel Spaß beim Hören.
Hello, Anne Petermann. Nice that you have time to talk to us today and welcome to our podcast Hingehört und Nachgefragt.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you. Anne Petermann, you work for the Global Justice Ecology Project and you co-founded it also. What are the aims of the project?
The idea of Global Justice Ecology Project, especially being located in the United States, is to bridge the gap between social justice issues and activism and environmental activism, because in the US they're very separated. And we feel that the only way that we can progress and have success is if we unify these movements and have environmental work and social work as well as economic justice work all coming together and looking for and identifying their common root causes and directing our activism at those root causes. So that's why we founded Global Justice Ecology Project back in 2003, which was right kind of in the height of the global justice movement, which was a movement that very much had similar aims.
Thank you. And also the Stop GE Trees campaign emerged from this project. Would you like to tell us how this came about?
Sure. In 1999, with our previous organization, we were running delegations down to various places in Central America, Southeast Mexico, Nicaragua. And on one of the delegations to Southeast Mexico, Oren Langell, who's the co-founder, was introduced to a greenhouse field trial of what he was told were genetically engineered trees. And we had been working on GMO issues not related to forests, and we had also been working on forest protection issues. So we had an understanding of the intrinsic dangers of genetically engineered trees with regard to forests, kind of right, just as we were learning about it, we knew that these could potentially be very problematic. And then we looked into anyone else that was working on genetically engineered tree activism and found out that there was like maybe four or five people in the world that were not industry or were not researchers that had ever heard of genetically engineered trees. So because there was nobody working on that issue and we understood it to be a potentially catastrophic problem, if you will, we decided to launch a campaign, which we did in March of 2000. With a press conference in Boston at the Biotechnology Industry Organization's annual conference.
Wow, thank you. Yeah, currently you work a lot on Brazil and the company Suzano. Suzano is a Brazilian multinational company that produces cellulose and paper products from eucalyptus plantations. Suzano has made applications for several genetically engineered eucalyptus trees in Brazil, which have been authorized by Brazil's National Technical Commission on Biosecurity. Before we go to the trees, let's take a look at Susano. Can you comment on the economics of the sector in Susano's role?
Well, it's the largest pulp and paper company in Brazil and is one of the largest in the world. And they are greatly expanding their production capacity in Brazil right now, which is happening in response to a global, an incredibly rapid global increase in demand for pulp. By 2030, the demand for pulp is projected to increase globally by the same amount that is currently being produced in Latin America. So that's a huge amount. And much of that increase in production is being aimed at Brazil and Latin America. So Brazil and Chile in particular, but other countries as well. So we're seeing, especially in Brazil, this massive expansion of industrial eucalyptus plantations to fill this rising global demand for pulp. And Suzano is right at the lead of all of that.
Okay, so it's a really big fish.
It's a very big fish, yes, a
Okay.
very dangerous one too.
Okay. So, to get a little closer to the ground, take us to an eucalyptus plantation in Brazil. What does it look like there?
Eucalyptus plantations, in Brazil, they call them green deserts. The people who are concerned about them and the people who have to live near them call them green deserts. And the reason that they call them that, is because they literally don't sustain life. Okay, so they are these huge expanses of trees. They are a single species of tree, a eucalyptus hybrid, usually either Eucalyptus globulus or a Europhala hybrid, and they are all the same age. And they that that's all that grows there is those trees. They're sprayed with herbicides so that nothing else can grow underneath them. They're sprayed with insecticides if necessary to get rid of insects. They deplete water because they grow incredibly fast. They can be harvestable size within 5 to 7 years. So they grow incredibly fast. They deplete a lot of water, leaving communities nearby with no water. The water that is there is contaminated by all of these chemicals. They deplete the soils because they grow so fast. So they have to, be fertilized. The soils have to be fertilized. And they're just extremely destructive. No native biodiversity can live in them because the trees themselves, the eucalyptus trees, are not native anywhere in the Americas. In fact, they're only native to parts of Australasia. And so, yeah, it's hard to imagine how destructive they are unless you actually see them and see that they're green, but there's nothing that grows in them.
Okay, wow, that sounds really bleak indeed. Huh? Yes, Suzano was created through the merge and takeover of various Brazilian cellulose and paper companies. And today, Suzano owns a lot of land in Brazil, right? Which includes several territories belonging to indigenous and peasant communities. What does it mean for the local people and how are their lives affected by living on land that belongs to Suzano?
Well, just to back up for a second, Suzano took that land, right? So in many cases, the land doesn't actually have clear titles. So
Okay.
where these companies have advantage is that many of the communities that live in Brazil and a lot of other countries don't have clear title to their land, even though they've been living there for potentially generations or even longer. So, especially indigenous communities in Brazil under the dictatorship, many indigenous communities were stripped of their lands and their lands were given over to timber multinationals and other private interests for development into industrial agriculture and various ranching, beef, etc. So, these communities were there. Ha should have legal title to that land, but because of the way the law works, they don't. And so Suzano has taken advantage of that and expanded their operations into areas without clear title to the lands. Even though people are fighting very hard to get that title, the process is very slow, and many of the Congress people that are in the government are completely opposed to people getting land title. So it's not just indigenous communities, though, it's also Quilombola communities, who are Afro-Brazilian communities, descendants of former slaves that were in Brazil, who have formed communities and territories and also been there for generations. So these are all communities that are trying to regain some kind of land title, some kind of legal authorization to be on their lands. And in the meantime, Suzano and other companies are taking advantage of the lack of title, taking over those lands, even illegally sometimes, even where there is title, they take the lands and they put their eucalyptus plantations on them. So some of these communities are completely surrounded by these plantations, or they've got a lot of plantations nearby and their water is gone, or their water is severely depleted, or it's contaminated. The drift from the chemicals sprayed on the plantations may drift into their communities. Really, we heard from these communities directly. We went there and we interviewed them, we spoke with them, and they talked about how incredibly difficult it is. And even to the point where Suzano will send in drones and security forces to monitor what the communities are doing. So they're living with the plantations, but they're also living with this repressive security culture where they can't even live their lives in peace.
Yeah, how do the local people cope with this difficult living conditions?
They just go on. I mean, this is where they live. This is their land. This is their territory. You know, it's not like they can pick up and move. So, you know, they're trying very hard to regain land title. They're going to the authorities and telling them what's going on and trying to register complaints. It's just, you know, it all depends on who the local authorities are, if they will listen or if they will just turn a deaf ear.
And do you see any hope that they can return to their normal life?
People are actually taking direct action in some of these communities and reclaiming the eucalyptus. So there are communities, there's an indigenous community called the Petosho people that are in southern Bahia and other places in the area where eucalyptus are being grown, who have taken direct action to remove some of the eucalyptus plantations so that they can regain the territory and, you know, for their own villages. MST, which stands for the Landless Workers Movement in Brazil, have been very active over the last 30 or 40 years in taking over eucalyptus plantations and removing the eucalyptus trees to create camps for landless people. Where people can now grow crops, you know, have housing, have communities. So they've been very active at that. And anyway, it is a trend in Brazil for people to take over these eucalyptus plantations and reestablish their own territories, their own needs. It is something, of course, that Suzano's not very happy about. So there's a lot of repression and a lot of the MST, for example, has been declared under the previous Bolsonaro administration. He was the previous president of Brazil, saying that the MST was an illegal movement, and they suffered a lot of repression from the government and paramilitaries because of their work to reclaim land and give it to landless people. But they continue. Everybody continues doing what they're doing because they absolutely, you know, they need this land, they need the territory. That it's the only way that they can survive.
Yeah, thank you for this view. I would like to direct our conversation towards genetically engineered plants and their role in all of this. Nine genetically engineered eucalyptus varieties are currently authorized for commercial cultivation in Brazil. And the newest tree was only approved in 2023, I guess. Yeah, what properties do these eucalyptus trees have?
Yeah, so Suzano has received permission through their subsidiary, which is called Futuragene, which is based in Brazil and Israel, has received permission for nine different genetically engineered trees. The first one was back in 2015. It was a faster growing eucalyptus tree. They never actually ended up using it because the authorization process took so long that they actually had faster growing trees through their cloning technology. But anyway, their breeding program. The other ones are more traditional genetically engineered traits like you see in agriculture. So, for example, they have herbicide-resistant genetically engineered eucalyptus trees, which, you know, use very similar technology to the herbicide-resistant soy and corn, and other crops. So it's Roundup is the herbicide. It's a glyphosate-based herbicide. The World Health Organization has identified it as a probable carcinogen. People all over the world get very sick and from the exposure to Roundup, and yet, agriculture continues to use it in very large amounts, especially when the crops are genetically engineered to resist it. Obviously, there's a incentive or an ability to use even more of the herbicide than is already used. And as we've seen in agriculture, where they started using these crops in the 80s, there are herbicide-resistant weeds now that have developed, evolved over time. So the idea that Suzano now wants to use this exact same technology for their eucalyptus trees so that they can spray their eucalyptus plantations broadly, and the eucalyptus trees won't be killed or impacted, means that there's going to be an even larger amount of that herbicide being sprayed, and even more impact on the local communities. So that's the one trait. The other trait is an insect resistance trait. Again, so they, would reduce the amount of, or the, it would reduce the expense they need to spend on it, spraying insecticides if the trees themselves, every cell of the tree is an insecticide. And interestingly, they use the same technology as in crops, which is a BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, bacteria that they've inserted into the trees. And they've actually used three different ones. They're called cry proteins. They've used three different ones in the same tree, which is a little unusual. So they're covering their bases. They want to make sure that these trees kill the insects. But the most besides all of the impacts of those trees, the most I guess dangerous thing that they've done is created trees with what they call stacked traits. So those are genetically engineered trees that have all of these different genetically engineered properties. So they're herbicide resistant and they kill insects and they're faster growing. So, each of these traits by itself is very risky and has unpredictable impacts and can cause side effects and, mutations and all of these things that they have no idea what will be the impacts over time, nor do they care really. But when you put them all together, you put together three different traits in the same tree. Now you've magnified the potential risks and the potential dangers from those trees. And yet the biosafety regime in Brazil has, given them the rubber stamp. They've said, sure, sounds good, go ahead. And the communities are very, very concerned about this, as you can imagine, since they know some of the impacts will mean more chemicals in their water, more chemicals drifting onto their communities, but there are also these unknowns. What will happen when these trees go, stop working correctly or have these unexpected risks, excuse me, unexpected impacts that nobody knows what they'll be? They're very concerned about that. In addition, the insect resistance trees, a lot of people in these low rural areas that have all of these eucalyptus plantations nearby, produce honey. That's one thing that the eucalyptus plantations are good for, is bees can use the flowers to produce honey. But if they are insect resistant and they're starting to kill these bees, or they're just GMO at all, they're just GMO trees, that means that the honey producers are either going to not be able to produce honey because their bees are dead, or they're not going to be able to sell their honey because it's now GMO. So there's a big concern about that, the socioeconomic impacts of these trees on these rural areas.
And are there opportunities for the affected communities in Brazil to influence the authorization process for genetically engineered trees?
No, it's
No,
not
okay.
really. In 2015, when the first GE tree from Suzano came up for possible review by the biosafety committee, There were protests all over the world at Brazilian consulates trying to say, don't approve this tree. The MST did an action, the MST women actually did an action at a Futuragene greenhouse where they were developing genetically engineered eucalyptus trees and destroyed the entire greenhouse. And the La Via Campesina, which is the global small peasants movement, they actually went into the Biosafety Commission's meeting and shut it down. So, people have taken a lot of action to stop this because of the fact that the biosafety regime does not include public's concerns. They're more about rubber stamping GMOs for industry's profit and bottom line.
Yes, I read on your homepage in a report of you that the approval process of the Brazil's National Technical Commission on Biosecurity for Genetically Engineered Eucalyptus in 2021 took only 5 months for the approval of those trees. That seems insanely short for a novel tree for me. What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, if you want to know the risks of any genetically engineered organism, you have to follow the entire life of that organism. You have to follow its progeny, its offspring, see what happens to them and their offspring. I mean, you really need to follow the line to see what happens as the tree develops, as it, reproduces, et cetera, in various conditions, right? What happens if it is, in a drought condition, what happens if it's in a freezing condition? What happens in all of these different environmental conditions that cause the genetics of the tree to respond in some way? Of course, they didn't do any of that. They just, it, you know, Suzano, I'm sure, provided them some studies that said, oh, these are fine. They don't have any impacts. And so the Biosafety Commission said, okay, sounds good. But no, yeah, if you really want to know the impacts of a GE tree, it's going to take decades at least of incredibly diverse research in many different areas. And of course, we don't even want these things released into the environment because of their extreme risks. So, in our estimation, GE trees should just be straight out banned.
Another point that irritated me are the carbon credits and author certifications. You write on your homepage that the cellulose and paper companies can actually get carbon credits and REDD certifications. Those are reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation certifications for the plantations for growing eucalyptus. And this means that the cultivation count is a measure to slow down climate change and the company gets money for it. Is that right?
That's correct. And some of that money anyway is coming from the US government as part of their commitment to climate change.
Yeah, so are these procedures really only about planting trees, regardless of which ones and how?
Yeah, well, it would seem that way, yes. Initially, I think, the UN's RED program was meant to reduce deforestation, by which I understood it to mean, stopping the cutting down of native forests. But it has, devolved, I guess, into these carbon credit schemes where it doesn't matter what tree or where it grows, as long as it's a tree and it's growing, it can be eligible for carbon credits. And it's turned into an extremely, it was always problematic, the idea of carbon offsets, offsetting pollution. Trees can't absorb fossil fuel pollution. It's scientifically ridiculous. But, it's something that has been very convenient for the polluting industries to say, oh, well, we'll offset our pollution just by planting some trees. The UN has been part of the problem in a big way because the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, which kind of takes care of the problems of or the issues relating to forests in the world, does not have a distinction between a native forest, a wild forest, and an industrial plantation. In their eyes, a forest is anything that has, I think it's 10% of tree cover. Doesn't matter if it's a native tree cover, doesn't matter where it is. if there's any biodiversity, it's just about 10% of tree cover. So that means that anything that's a tree plantation can count as a forest. So when you lose in a particular year, let's say you lose, 3 million hectares of wild forest, but you plant 4 million hectares of industrial tree plantations, it counts as a million hectares of more forest, right? Even though it's actually 3 million acres, hectares less of forest. So it's been extremely problematic, that definition, and a lot of forest protection and indigenous rights groups around the world have been campaigning to get the UN to change their definition, but they simply refuse to. So as a result, companies like Suzano can use that giant loophole to say that they are planting forests. That's how they say it. Using that confusion. So they're not planting forests, they're planting these green deserts. And what's happening is forested land in Brazil that is very carbon rich because it's got carbon in the trees, it has carbon in the soil, in all of the other plants that are there, the biodiversity, all of these things, all create a very carbon rich environment. Those forests are being destroyed, literally clear cut and removed to expand these industrial tree plantations. When you do that, of course, you release all of the carbon from the soil, not to mention the trees and everything else that grew there. So you've just released a whole lot of carbon into the atmosphere, and then you're replacing it with these very carbon poor eucalyptus plantations. And there was a study from the early 90s that looked at the carbon sequestration potential of a native forest in a tropical area like Brazil versus a plantation. And they found that native forests in those areas stored about four times as much carbon as the eucalyptus plantations. So, we're talking about an ex not only are you releasing all of this carbon when you destroy that forest, when you then replace it with a plantation, you've also dramatically decreased the amount of carbon that that land can store. So it's moving in the exact wrong direction. And yet, because these rules, these definitions of what is tree planting and what can count as a forest carbon offset are so ridiculous, Suzano's getting paid to do this very destructive, climatologically destructive work.
With all the bad side effects and consequences you already mentioned, with the pesticides and chemicals, and the loss of biodiversity, what comes with the
Exactly.
plantations and also with the genetically engineered trees, then. Yeah, let's change the hemisphere and go to North America, to the USA, where a lot of research is being carried out here on genetically engineered trees. And a long-standing project by researchers was the development of an American chestnut tree called Darling 58, which were to be made more resistant to a fungus using genetic engineering. And this fungus is responsible for the death of many of those famous trees in the eastern USA. Yeah, but the Darling 58 project was stopped at the beginning of this year. Can you tell us what's happened?
Sure, yeah, it's a long story, but
Make it
basically,
short for us.
yes, basically the American chestnut, as you mentioned, was largely destroyed in the eastern United States by an introduced blight from Asia, and in the process of trying to stop the blight from spreading, many, many trees that were healthy were cut down, and that, further damaged the population by potentially eliminating trees that might have had some resistance to the blight. At this, so there's been many efforts since this happened to try to bring the chestnuts back. And the two main efforts that were happening up until about the 80s were a hybridization program to breed the wild American chestnuts with the Chinese chestnuts, which have natural resistance, and try to create a naturally resistant American chestnut. That's had some success. They're like at 15/16th American chestnut at this point. But the trees don't do well in the forest. They have the characteristics of a Chinese chestnut, so they're short and they're bushy. They don't do well in a forest. And then another organization has been breeding wild American chestnuts with each other to create blight-resistant wild American chestnuts. And they've been having a lot of success. And starting in 2022 and 23, they started actually distributing the nuts from these blight-resistant wild American chestnuts and starting to develop, starting to spread this blight-resistant American chestnut population. So that's been pretty encouraging. That's been pretty exciting to be a part of. At the same time, though, starting in the late 80s, this genetically engineered chestnut research started from people that were mainly too impatient to wait for the wild American chestnut population to become blight resistant naturally or with the help of humans, and thought that the hybridization program was too slow and wasn't working, whatever. They wanted to genetically engineer them. So they did. And they've been working on it, they've been working on it very hard since about 2013. And in 2016, the American Chestnut Foundation and the Environmental Science of the College of Environmental Science and Forestry joined together, and we're working on this project together for all these years. And then in 2020, the College of Environmental Science and Forestry submitted a petition to the US government asking for permission to release these chestnuts, deregulate them, release them unmonitored into wild forest to spread. They're fully fertile, so they can spread themselves. And the idea was that they would contaminate the remaining wild American chestnuts in the forest with this blight resistance trait, and then it would be passed on and on and on to all the to eventually, replace all of the wild American chestnuts with these GE variants. But what happened is that in 2023, in the fall of 2023, the American Chestnut Foundation revealed that their GE trees were not doing any very well. This is 3 years after they asked the government for permission to release them with no monitoring. 3 years after that, they discovered the trees were not doing very well. They were dying. They were not blight resistant anymore. They were stunted. They looked terrible. And they did a bunch of research to try to figure out what was going on, and they eventually discovered that the trees they had been working on, which, as you mentioned, was the Darling 58, which is a variety of this tree that they had developed over time, was the wrong tree. So back in 2016, the researchers at the College of Environmental Science and Forestry gave the researchers at the American Chestnut Foundation the wrong pollen. So they gave them pollen from another darling tree called the Darling 54, which had the gene, the transgene from wheat, which is what conveys the blight resistance, inserted into a different chromosome on top of or in the middle of another gene. So it destroyed a gene in the American chestnut tree and caused all of these genetic defects to happen. So the American Chestnut Foundation at that point said, "Wow, you gave us the wrong pollen. These trees are all dying. We're pulling out. We don't back this anymore. We don't think these trees should be approved by the government. We don't think that they should be used for restoration. They're just not appropriate." So they took a big step back from all of this. But the College of Environmental Science and Forestry, on the other hand, is still moving forward to try to deregulate these trees. They're saying, "Oh no, they're fine. They're fine. They don't have any problems." And we've done tests to show this, although the tests, they admit on their website that the tests are extremely preliminary and short, very short tests because they've been using the wrong tree all this time. So they really don't know, but they say they do. Anyway, so the tree is still going through the deregulation process, but one of the main partners has said, "No, this is a bad idea." And for us, it's a major red flag. It says, genetically engineering trees is fraught with unpredictable problems and risks and dangers. And the American chestnut is a perfect example of that. Because it turns out the American Chestnut Foundation later revealed that even if they did not have that pollen problem, even if they'd gotten the correct pollen, the trait that they had engineered, or the, excuse me, the way that they had engineered the trait into the tree was itself problematic. And what would have eventually caused what they call gene silencing, so the loss of the blight resistance trait in those trees, that would have been caused anyway. Even without the pollen problem, the trees would have eventually lost their blight resistance because of this gene silencing problem that was known with the technology that they used to engineer the trees. It's basically, a lot of scientists already knew that that was a major problem, and scientists that we work with are like, why did they use that? This technology that's known to cause problems. Anyway, all of that to say that, the genetically engineered American chestnut tree research was a total failure, and for us is a big red flag about genetically engineering trees, full stop.
The American chestnut project differs from the genetically engineered eucalyptus trees from Brazil in that they are not to be planted in plantations for the timber industry, but in the forest. Now, this is where the genetically engineered trees are supposed to establish themselves and spread. That is something we always wanted to avoid with GMOs, right? That they
Yes.
establish themselves. And even if this project, the American chestnut, is stopped now for the time being, I fear that the idea of manipulating wild populations through genetic engineering will remain. And with all the new techniques, as CRISPR-Cas also will, gain more research and all of this. How do you view the use of genetic engineering in forest trees and wild populations?
Yeah, it's clearly a bad idea. The genetically engineered American chestnut, if it had been approved, would have been the first time ever that a GMO plant was allowed to be released into the environment with the intention of self-replicating, of spreading its genes to the wild population. It's not unique in the world of genetic engineering, full, across the board, because they are trying to do this now with gene edited species. These gene edited mosquitoes that are supposed to, be sterile, spread sterility through their population, and various projects that they're doing that they now want to be self-spreading. It's just so incredibly short-sighted. Because they're irreversible. These are irreversible scientific experiments, right? You can't release a GMO into the environment to spread itself, and then think you will be able to stop it if something happens. And the American chestnut, as I mentioned, they had studied it for 3 years in a controlled field trial. And before they asked the government for permission to release them into wild forests. If they had gotten that permission and those genetically defective trees had been released into forests and people had been going in there and planting them all over the place, without any record of where they were going, those genetic defects would have eventually gotten into the wild population. And then the American chestnut would have really been in a bad situation. Because now it's being attacked by the blight and this genetic defect. So, I think, as I mentioned, that's a real cautionary tale about not allowing these irreversible genetic experiments with wild ecosystems.
You're working with a network of different organizations on the American chestnut, and which indigenous organizations are also involved. The situation of the indigenous communities differs from that in Brazil of various reasons, sure, but also because of the genetically engineered trees fulfill a different purpose. We already talked about that. Are there nevertheless similarities in terms of how the communities are affected?
Yeah, I mean the differences in how indigenous communities would be impacted by genetically engineered trees, of course, depends on geography, on the tree, and so on. In the US, the risk was that these genetically engineered trees, these chestnut trees, would spread onto indigenous territories without the permission or knowledge of those indigenous communities, and that they would These are communities that had traditionally harvested American chestnuts historically, and their medicine, their bark for medicine, and so on. If these trees are now genetically engineered and the population doesn't know that or hasn't had any say so in that, that's a big problem in terms of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples on free, prior, and informed consent, and so forth. And so there's been a lot of resistance from Indigenous communities in the United States because of that, because of this lack of consultation about this irreversible threat to their culture or food or, many different areas. In places like Brazil, of course, where you're talking about an industrial tree plantation, the differences are much more pronounced, I guess you could say. The people in Brazil and Chile and other countries in Latin America were forcibly kicked off of their land for these eucalyptus plantations, pine plantations, industrial tree plantations. And so, that was a complete disruption of their lives, of their cultures, of their histories, all of these things that people lost when they were displaced from their lands. And now, of course, in these they're on these smaller territories. Some of them have title, most of them don't. So these threats are ongoing. They could again be moved. They could lose even more of their land, as well as the impacts from the eucalyptus plantations themselves. The loss of water. In Chile, some of the communities that are surrounded by eucalyptus plantations that once had year-round supplies of fresh water now only can get water from trucks. They have to have trucks bring water to them because all the water is gone. Or they have the contamination problems, the contamination of the water, the air, their crops. And of course, the repression, the political repression of the companies in Brazil, in Chile, it seems to be even worse, where the Mapuche people, the indigenous people in Chile who are resisting the large company Arauco, which is what do you call a competitor of Suzano, they are being jailed for decades because of their resistance to these plantations. They're being killed, shot dead, which is also happening in Brazil, actually, with the Pataxó people. So, I mean, it's literally a matter of life and death with the indigenous communities in Latin America, who are impacted by and/or resisting these industrial tree plantations.
Yeah, and you already said that they have no possibility to be involved in the whole process of the authorization of where
Right.
those trees are going to be grown, everything like this. Is this different in the USA? Are there ways the indigenous people can take part in the decision if and where those trees can or should be planted?
Sure. Yeah. That's also a little complicated. So the regulations over GMOs in the United States have recently radically changed. Before the changes, there's a process called the National Environmental Policy Act that includes provisions that indigenous communities should be consulted about the potential impacts the GMO might have on on them and their communities. How much that's actually, followed is a whole other question, but the provision is there. And I think with the American chestnut, there was some, but not very much consultation. But now that the rules have changed, they've basically said that they don't need to do that risk assessment anymore, that the government, that is, that the companies can do the risk assessments themselves and decide for themselves if there is a potential risk. And if they decide that there is no risk, then they don't need the government to authorize it, or they can write the government and say, we don't think there's a risk. And if the government says, okay, that's fine, then they don't need to be regulated. So now there was at one point a way for indigenous communities in the United States to be involved at some level. It was required, but now there is basically not a way for people to be involved. The public in general doesn't have the right anymore to see what's going on, to know what's being planned, to know what's being released, to know what's being deregulated. And what, when I say what's being deregulated, I mean specifically what are the traits that have been included in these new GMOs, what technologies were used, blah, blah, blah. All of these, really important technical details are now considered confidential business information, and the public is not allowed to see them. The public is not allowed to comment. There's just, it's the public has been completely cut out of the process in the United States.
Not good news. Sorry to hear that. Also, but I still try to finish with something nice. Maybe
Yeah.
you already mentioned something. But yeah, maybe you can tell us about your favorite and most promising conventional approach to restore the American chestnut at the moment.
Sure. Yeah. There's an organization in the US that's been around for about 40 years called the American Chestnut Cooperators Foundation. And they are very anti-GMO. They don't want GE trees. They don't want GE chestnuts. And they have been dedicated to finding these large surviving American chestnuts that are still out in the forest that were not killed by the blight when it went through at the turn of the last century. And they are taking nuts and pollen from those trees and breeding them together to, with the aim of creating an increasingly blight-resistant wild American chestnut, with 100% wild American chestnut genes. And they've been very successful. So they have, they believe, they have now produced trees that are blight-resistant enough. And they're very clear, they're not 100% blight resistant. They will get the blight at some point, but the idea is that they'll get the blight, but they can survive the blight long enough to reproduce themselves. So it's a self-sustaining population of wild American chestnuts that will over time become even more blight resistant. So they're very happy with the progress they've made. They've started distributing these these American chestnuts that have some level of blight resistance to other people to start growing them. We grow some here. The Seneca Nation, which is the indigenous community that we're living on their traditional land, they've started growing some. There's a botanical garden in New England. They're growing several hundred of them as part of like a test, a field test, if you will. So it's that's where the real positive future is for, the American chestnut. And I think it sends an example of what can be done with the old-fashioned traditional breeding. I mean, we see the results of old-fashioned traditional breeding all over, and why this is now being said to be, oh, that's antiquated, and we can do much better things in the lab by, genetically tweaking things, causing all of these unpredictable mutations and problems and unpredictable impacts is, doesn't make any sense to me. But, human arrogance, I suppose. But anyway, so yeah, the wild American chestnut is coming back, and it's great to see.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you, Anne Petermann, for the interesting interview, and your important work.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
All right. I appreciate it.
Das war das Gespräch mit Anne Petermann zu gentechnisch veränderten Bäumen und indigenem Widerstand mit Judith Duisberg vom Genethischen Netzwerk. Mehr zum Thema findet ihr in unseren Shownotes und auf unserer Webseite www.gen-ethisches-netzwerk.de. Wenn ihr Feedback für uns habt oder Fragen, schreibt uns gerne eine Mail an podcast@gen-ethisches-netzwerk.de. Das Genethische Netzwerk ist ein gemeinnütziger Verein. Wir sind für die unabhängige kritische Arbeit, zu der auch dieser Podcast gehört, auf Spenden von Einzelpersonen angewiesen. Wenn euch die Folge gefallen hat, lasst uns doch als Dankeschön eine Spende da. Das geht ganz einfach online unter www.gen-ethisches-netzwerk.de/spenden. Danke und bis zum nächsten Mal.